Nationally, the turnover rate for correctional officers is more than 15%. Working in a prison is a stressful and dangerous job, but it can also be rewarding. Sitting in for Ben Kiefer, I'm Clay Masters, and today on River to River, we meet an individual who works at an Iowa prison. And also, the union AFSCME claims that the Department of Corrections has insufficient staff numbers running the state's correctional facilities, and as a result, correctional officers are at risk. We look into these criticisms to get a better sense of how Iowa prisons operate. Join our conversation after this news. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Today, we continue our series on the Iowa Department of Corrections with a look at staffing. Since 2008, the number of full-time employees working in Iowa's prisons have decreased by more than 450 employees. Some say the staffing numbers are concerning, while others think it's what the state can do with the budget it has. We'll get into those details on that issue later in the program, but first, we wanted to get some perspective of what it's like to actually work in one of Iowa's prisons and also how staffing decisions are generally made. And we also want to hear from you. Have you ever worked in a prison or lived in a prison? What was your sense of how well the prison was staffed? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100, or let us know on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Now, my first guest here joining me in our Des Moines studios is Wade Barkus. He has worked at Mitchellville since November of 1999. Prior to working as a corrections officer, he was a Marine. Like I said, he joins us in our Des Moines studio. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Clay.
So first, just give us an idea of what it is to do your job.
Well, it can be very challenging. It's something different every day. Like I said, you're working with people who've the inmates have never – a lot of them, a majority of them have never had an upbringing like as far as the rules, discipline and everything. And they've went through some tough times. And when they come in, we have to reshape them. And it can be a very demanding process. So they're like I said, learning rules that they've never had to use before. So – follow. So we give them the steps they need to get out of prison and become a better citizen. And that's an ongoing process every day.
And I think a lot of people tend to have kind of this movie idea of what a prison guard or a correction officer's job is.
Yes.
Breaking up fights or whatever that might be. But I'd imagine there's a wide variety of things that you have to do on a day-to-day basis. Can you share some of those?
Yes. I mean, and those are very isolated. That stuff, like you said, the movies, it does not happen every
right.
day. And basically we're just it could go from helping them along the way, getting them jobs, learning new trades. I mean, there's numerous staff out there as far as officers and counselors and people helping them on a daily basis. So we're in their living units and helping them. They can be cleaners, everything, work in the kitchen. We're trying to give them skills so when they get out, they can become a better citizen than when they came in. It's really every day is reshaping and reforming their lives.
And also, just like you're trying to teach them or help them with many different aspects, you kind of have to be a jack of all trades as well, too. I mean, especially regardless of staffing numbers, there's a lot of things that you have to do. Kind of explain, you're not just watching people in their cells, you're working with them. Explain the process
yes,
of the different things.
Exactly. We have a lot of staff that have to show them the job step by step that they're going to be doing and here's how you're going to do this and here's how you're going to follow this rule. And you have to go over with them everything. And like you said, you're just not watching them. They're not just in a cell every day. They're in general population. They're in living units. We have treatment units. I mean, we have the lockup, the segregation ones for the ones that are discipline problems. But they're out every day walking amongst the community. And, we're helping them along. And they have to learn everything step by step from day one. And it's just it's just an ongoing process, and it's a great thing.
So what do you do every day then? Is there kind of a routine?
You know, you revolve around. You can work – you could be in a treatment unit one day. You could be working in a segregation unit the next day, general population.
What's a segregation unit?
It's for discipline problems, like if they're fighting, stealing, anything. We have to send them down there for a period of time. So you hop around and, you know – everybody works about everything out there. So, I mean, it's that's why I'd say every day is different, and it's nice if you enjoy the challenge. It's not for everyone. Not everyone's going to stay.
So what was your Friday like?
Last Friday?
Yeah, sure.
I was off last Friday.
Okay. I guess the last time you were there, just walk us through a day, like a specific day.
The day before, I was – I think I was working in our segregation, our 6B lockup unit, and you get them out for – they come out for exercise. They can come out for showers, and we have to secure them and take them to these places. And then we have exercise cells, and we have to feed them. We have to open their flaps, and you're going all around. You might have 50, 60 inmates in the unit. Sometimes it's lower. And they're our problem inmates. We have SSIP, which is suicide self-injuries prevention. We have special programs for them down there. We have inmates that have special needs and mental issues and everything. So, I mean, you're working with them and counseling them every day and helping them out down there. And it can be – that unit can be a very challenging unit.
And I understand that there was a time when you were attacked by an inmate. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can't remember the incident. It was quite a few years ago. We were going to cuff up an inmate and take her down to segregation, and she lunged at me, and we got her down there safely. And like I said, they're very isolated when they happen, but they do happen. And she was down there for a long period of time. She was very troublesome, and she's been out there quite a while, and she's going to be getting out soon. And I have recently talked to her, and she's doing great now. She's in general population. She holds a job, and she told me, she said, I'm such a different person now. And she said, you know, and she'll tell staff, you guys have always treated me very nice, and it was, you know, I was the problem, and you guys always worked with me. And a lot of times they'll come out of that, and they'll learn that that's not the way they want to be. And they get wiser, and they're going to be getting out. And she's a total different person. They can change.
They can change, and in some instances, they might not change.
Yes.
Are there a lot of – I mean, a lot of people might not want to work in a prison. They would consider it maybe depressing. And if there are people that, you know, are not changing and you're not seeing change
yes.
over time, what do you like about your job if that's – the normalcy for you?
Like you said, there are difficult ones that we'll never try to change, and we try to help them as much as we can. They have to help themselves as well. But I like the challenges. And like you said, it's not for everyone. There's people that come and go all the time. It's something different every day. You got to just hang in there, and if you like it, you're going to grow to like it, just like any job. So a police officer, a nurse. Most people get in, and with proper training, they're going to become the best staff they can. They're going to enjoy their job. That's the biggest thing out there. I mean, if you really learn how to do your job and do it to your best, then everything is going to fall into place.
Warden Patty Wankendorf of Mitchellville Correctional Institute for Women, where you work, talked with us before the show discussing how she stays grounded and positive. Here's what she had to say.
Prison people, and I will say this because I've been here 30 years, can get cynical, and we always have to watch that. You know, when I get frustrated, I go out and walk the yard and talk to the women about this is why I'm here, because you want to make a difference. You do have to watch your frustrations. You know, I don't want to take my frustrations out on staff, and sometimes I do. You know, you just have to be careful so that you don't get cynical, and you focus on the positive. Otherwise, this is a negative environment. Prison can be a negative environment just because of what you deal with every day. And I tell staff and tell myself that most of the women are positive and want to go home, so we have to focus on that. And some days it's tough. You know, some days you just want to throw your hands up in the air. But You go home, I go running, and I'm ready to come in the next day. You know, there's never been a day that I'm not ready to come back to work because it is rewarding. But there are tough days, truly tough days.
That's Warden Patty Wankendorf of Mitchellville Correctional Institute for Women. She's discussing how she stays grounded and positive. You work in a women's prison. Are there differences between a women's prison versus a male's? Have you worked in a men's prison?
I've been to a lot of the men's prisons mm-hmm. for training and stuff. I've never worked in one. I've heard there are differences. Of course, women are more emotional and they're going to a lot of times speak their mind more, need to talk through things. Other than that, I really don't never worked in the men's prison to know really what all the differences would be.
Is there some kind of male influence that goes on here because of the gender differences?
I think they're really – I mean it's – they're – it all – you know, a lot of them never had male or female influences and people to be positive for them and show them the way, and that really, you know, can help them change and – seeing that, and a lot of them, that's what they'll say. They're like, you. A lot of the staff out there are most positive people they've ever been around and coming to prison. So,
now, there was a suicide attempt mentioned. Talk a little bit about that and how that gets handled with the staff that's there.
Well, a lot of it is just our staff being attentive and aware of their surroundings. A lot of them are, they're seeking attention through things like that, and if our staff are usually catching that and at the right time and stopping it, it can really turn it around very well and very quickly. So those things do happen out there, and it's not something you want to see at all. It doesn't happen very often, but they will. They're crying out, and if you're paying attention and you're doing your job and you're putting your guard down, then you can stop those things.
So how do you stay alert all the time?
You know, it's really you learn after you're out there being so long, you learn the way things are going to be in day to day, and you can just feel when things are – the way inmates are acting, and you can't become complacent. If you're not happy in your job and you start becoming that way, then you're going to miss things. So,
there was an inmate who tried to commit suicide. Really, how did you stop her from doing it? I mean, there's interest – I know that – you know, people we've talked with are interested to know how that actually happens, how you physically get somebody to not do that.
Well, we had one run up one of the fire escapes, and that I and some other staff were on, and some of our older buildings have fire escapes on the outside, and she was hanging over the side, and staff on the ground were telling her, don't do it, and keeping her mind off. And I came up the back stairs and was able to bring her down off of it, and so everyone working together, really, everybody's trained well to learn how to get through those situations and help the inmates out.
You're listening to River on Iowa Public Radio. We're talking about staffing here in Iowa's correctional facilities. I want to bring Martin Horn into the conversation. He's with us by phone. He's a distinguished lecturer at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, which is located in Manhattan. Martin, are you there?
Yes, I am, Clay.
Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
So I know there's no one-size-fits-all formula here, but can you tell us a little bit about how staffing is determined as a whole?
Well, every prison is different. And I think Iowa, you can understand, you've got, I think, Fort Madison that I think was built in 1839 and Fort Dodge that was built in 1998. As you could well imagine, the architecture of every building is different. And the architecture affects the sight lines, and the sight lines affect the number of staff that you need to do the job. In addition, prisons have different missions. As Wade was saying, his facility works with women. You've got facilities that work with the mentally ill. You've got units within facilities that work with segregation inmates. And each of these carries with it a different manpower or person power, if you will, requirement. And so the best way to approach it is to analyze each physical building in terms of its mission, in terms of its policy, in terms of its procedures, the way in which it operates, the number of inmates, and determine the number of posts that need to be covered. So just For example, the front gate is a post, and that needs to be staffed. Does it require one person? Does it require two people? Does it have to be staffed 24 hours a day? Prisons operate 24 hours a day, so as you can well imagine, the housing units have to be covered 24 hours a day. Does it have to be covered 7 days a week? The visiting room has to be covered, but perhaps they only allow visits 5 days a week. So you have to determine the number of posts. You have to determine the number of shifts for which those posts need to be covered. And then you have to determine the number of days that your staff work. And so typically it requires, to cover one post 7 days a week, it requires more than one person. As you can well imagine, on average, a person works 5 days a week. So on the 2 days that they're off, you need someone else to cover that post. If the post operates 24 hours a day, it requires three people 7 days a week, and you have to factor in what I refer to as the relief factor. You have to determine the number of vacation days your staff take, the number of holidays the contract provides them with, and so on. And you have to decide, are the inmates escorted when they're allowed out of their cells? Do they come out as a congregate group? Do the inmates go to a dining hall as a group, or are the meals brought to them in their cells? All of these things factor into a thoughtful staffing analysis, which should yield what would be the ideal staffing for each facility. And the use of technology, for example, newer facilities make greater use of closed-circuit TV, and one officer standing in a control room can control multiple doors, whereas in the older prisons, each door that needed to be opened required an officer to be standing there with keys, and every time somebody entered or left, the door had to be manually closed and shut. The same thing is true in the housing units. In the older housing units, the inmates had to be locked in individually. In the newer ones, there are gang locks that will automatically, electronically, or pneumatically lock multiple cells in a row. So these are all factors that need to be considered by the prison administration in determining ideal staffing.
Now, there are currently about 527 inmates at Mitchellville, which is where you work, Wade Marcus, though capacity is about 455. And now Martin's talking about person power and technology changing the way prisons are structured and built. This new prison being built in Mitchellville, how's that going to affect your job?
It's going to be a lot more efficient. We're going to get more staff for it. It's going to run very well.
You're going to get more staff for it.
Yes.
Okay. And you've been working since 1999 mm-hmm. at this prison. You probably know it quite well now. How have things changed in the way that maybe technology is, or just the limits that maybe there is when, you know, we're talking about these newer prisons that Martin was saying have, you know, more intricate locking systems? How has the prison changed, and how have the prisoners changed in that time?
You know, really, since I've been there, things have, like you said, technology's come along a little farther. And as far as the building structures, everything's still the same as it was when I started. It's going to really take off when we move into the more efficient locking buildings, like you said. And there's going to be a lot more. Things are going to run a lot smoother than they do now as far as the buildings and where staff are going to be and all the movement and everything.
And you've also now seen some almost generations of people, you know, ages coming through the prisons. Have you seen any changes since 99 of what inmates are like? I mean, you talk about how none of them really are accustomed to rules, but has that grown, or what kind of trends have you seen in the prisoners themselves?
It changes year to year. There's mm-hmm. there's some that come in, you know, groups of them that just really aren't up to date with things, and there's, you know, it's really, I haven't seen the rules are the way we run things now are different than back then, and we get smarter and we get changes come along, and it I think it works out a lot better.
And what sort of person do you think excels as a correctional officer?
You know, it's someone that comes in there and they really love their job and they want to do it, and they learn it the best they can. that's going to be the best. I think a lot of people, we have people come from all walks of life, and we have military, we have police, we have nursing staff that come in there, and they just – everybody usually comes in and excels.
And you were talking about the rules and how they've kind of changed in the corrections officers. Can you expand a little bit on that?
On the – say again, please.
Just the way that the people have changed, or you were talking about rules and how they adapt to that.
For staff?
Yes.
Oh, it's – I mean, it's come a long ways over the last 10, 15 years, and it's – everyone just falls right into place, and the training we have and we go to and the things we learn, and it's not only the inmates, it's the staff as well, like you said, and it's moving towards the future. So
and Martin, have you seen any examples of ways that corrections policy has changed or the way that staffing has changed in the way that the prisons work with those that are incarcerated?
Well, sure. I think that we've become much smarter about the way in which we work with the variations among inmates. Inmates provide a wide range of personal experiences, and they present a wide range of needs. And so we do a much better job today of classifying inmates, identifying those who are minimum security, medium security, and maximum security. We do a much better job of paying attention to their individual risks and needs. I think that historically we spend a lot more time training our staff. We've learned how important, as Wade mentioned, teamwork is. So all of those changes factor in, and I think staff are much more sophisticated today about the jobs that they do than they were when I started 40 years ago.
And how is staffing determined nationally with a larger picture? I mean, how do states know where to start?
Well, as I said, there are documents that have been provided, handbooks and manuals that have been provided by the National Institute of Corrections, which is an arm of the federal government, that tell corrections administrators how to go about doing a staffing analysis, and it tells them to start with the physical structure of the facility, as I mentioned earlier, to determine the number of posts that are required based upon the day-to-day life and rhythm of the prison. What time do the inmates go to meals? Do the inmates go to meals 7 days a week, three times a day? How do they handle their medical sick leave? Is there an infirmary on premises, or is every inmate who gets ill taken outside to the emergency room? These are things that drive staffing needs, and once you've done that sort of analysis, and you've laid that against the number of work days that your officers are available to work, you can, through a fairly straightforward mathematical formula, determine the total number of bodies that you need to fill all of the required posts on all of the required shifts. You know, working in corrections is different from other fields. Let me compare it, for example, to policing. In corrections, if you've got a housing unit and that housing unit houses, for argument's sake, 50 inmates, someone has to be there to watch those 50 inmates 7 days a week on all three shifts. If an officer for whom that's the regular assignment is not available because of previously scheduled vacation or training or any other time off, it has to be covered. It's not like a police department where if an individual officer is not available on a given day, they can expand the post.
Okay, Martin, unfortunately, I know you're going to be here with us for the second half, but we're going to have to cut it off there. I know you're coming back. I want to make sure that I thank Wade Barkus for being here. Thanks for stopping by River to River today.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio. We'll be back after this brief news. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're continuing our summer series looking at Iowa's correctional facilities today with a look at staffing. Since 2008, the number of full-time employees working in Iowa's prisons has decreased by more than 450 employees. Some say the Department of Corrections has insufficient staff numbers running the state's correctional facilities, and it's putting officers at risk. We'll discuss that concern, and we also want to hear from you. Have you ever worked in a prison or lived in a prison? What was your sense of how well the prison was staffed? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Let us know on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, at IPR Talk. Back for the second half is Martin Horn, distinguished lecturer at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, which is located in New York. Martin, welcome back to second half. Sorry we had to cut you off there on the first part.
That happens.
And here for the second half is Representative Chip Baltimore, the Republican from Boone, serves as the House Judiciary Chair and sits on the Justice System Appropriations Committee in the Iowa House. He's here in our Des Moines studios. Welcome back.
Good morning, Clay. Thank you for having me.
And Danny Homan is also here in our Des Moines studios. He's the president for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME Iowa Council 61. Danny, welcome back to River to River.
Thank you.
So, Martin, I want to go back to you real quick. According to the American Corrections Association, the national turnover rate for correctional officers is more than 15%. What does this high turnover rate indicate?
Well, you know, being a correctional officer isn't for everyone. And it's a hard job, and a lot of people take it and leave very early. I think the good news is that in Iowa, from what I can tell, according to your Department of Administrative Services, your turnover rate in the Iowa DOC is only around 6%. And what that gives you is a more mature workforce. When you have a high turnover rate, you have inexperienced officers, whereas the average length of service in Iowa is substantially high. It's probably in the neighborhood of 12 years. So you've got an experienced, skilled workforce, and you don't want to lose them. You've made an investment in training them, and you don't want to lose them. I think some places lose staff because they don't pay them properly, they don't treat them properly, they don't support them properly.
Danny,
I don't think
the
case, and I don't think that there's evidence of that in Iowa.
Danny, I want to ask you, do you think Iowa's prisons are adequately staffed?
Absolutely not. I listened to the first part of the show, and the National Institute of Corrections was brought up. In 2005, there was an escape from the Fort Madison Penitentiary. In 2006, Governor Vilsack chartered or granted money for the department and asked me to do a joint staffing study. And at the conclusion of that staffing study, this is in 2008, the department was 400 to 600 staff short just on correctional officers. That wasn't anything else. It hasn't gotten better since 2000 or since 1998, FY98. Staff have gone down 12.19%, while inmates' population has gone up 6.26%. So the staffing in our prisons is going the wrong way, and it's evident by the number of assaults on officers, the type of assaults. We had a potential escape being planned at Fort Madison this month that due to the dedication of the officers there, we were able to discover it and stop it. Shortly after that, we had 10 inmates involved in a fight, and we had a CERT officer stabbed with a shiv. It just keeps going on and on and on. We're shrinking posts. We're eliminating posts. And heck, we were 400 to 600 short in 2008. I would hate to count what the number is today.
So, Martin, Danny is saying that these escapes are due in part because of a lack of staff. Are escapes common nationally?
Escape nationally is a relatively rare phenomenon nowadays, but they do occur. I think the more important point to bring forward is that the officers are being asked to do more, and I think that's evident in your own state's official reports. If you look at, again, the State Department of Administrative Services, in fiscal year 2010, your staff worked 15,700 days of overtime, whereas in fiscal 2011, they worked 21,225 days of overtime. That alone, 21,225 days of overtime, if you assume that an average officer works 220 hours net of vacations and sick leave and so on, is the equivalent right there of 100 officers. Last year, you spent close to $6 million on overtime. I would bet that's a one-third increase from the year before. So something suggests that there is a shortage of officers. How severe it is, I can't say, but I think Danny is on to something.
Representative Baltimore, you have a role in deciding what amount of money the Department of Corrections receives. What's your general sense on how Iowa's prisons operate and are staffed?
Well, I think generally we have a wonderful crew of employees that do an excellent job of not only protecting Iowans from the inmates that are there, but protecting inmates from each other and protecting themselves from the inmates as well. You know, I'm glad that Mr. Holman brought up the issue of safety, because when we look at some of the safety numbers, and I did a little bit of research on this before I came in, and if you look over just the last 4 years, in fiscal year 2013, we've had some of the lowest incident numbers amongst the inmates in those last 4 years. And let me just kind of go through this. You know, offender on offender with assaults with serious injury. You know, this past year, fiscal year 13, was the next lowest out of all 4 years. We've had far fewer disruptive offenders in the last year than we've had in any of the prior 4 years. We've had the lowest overall incidents in 2013 by a wide margin over those prior 4 years. So, you know, it's not enough to just sit here and count bodies when it comes to correctional officers. We have to look at are we appropriately staffed to keep the inmates under control, to keep them in prison and where they belong, and do that in a safe and responsible manner. You know, the escape that took place back in 2005, that took place at a time when we had one of the highest prison populations around. And it also took place at a time when we had, you know, a significantly higher number of correctional officers on duty. So, you know, look, I think that we can look at individual incidents and say, yes, there may be a problem at particular points in time, but I think it's also important to look at the global statistics and the global trends. You know, if I look at inmate populations from 2002 to now, you know, the prison populations are very, very similar, and the number of correctional officers that we have are very, very similar. So, you know, I think that, again, as one of your prior speakers mentioned, we're starting to use technology more and more. We're starting to use some of the remote surveillance techniques that we don't necessarily need to have a specific employee there to oversee every single aspect of it. And I think the more we see of that, the more efficiencies we're going to be able to have, and we'll see some of the numbers change. But I look at the overall safety trends as something that's very, very important that we need to keep an eye on.
Now, I should say we did extend an invitation to the Department of Corrections, and they did not want to be a part of today's conversation. So, I mean, maybe a question for them and a question for both of you would be, you know, we're having these conversations about how much technology is changing in prisons, but can technology replace person power?
Completely no. It can't, but it can make something much more efficient. You know, in the old days, and you know, going back certainly before my time, you used to have, you know, a prison guard physically viewing, you know, a row of cells to make sure that there were no problems there. We do a lot of that with remote televisions, television cameras these days. So, I mean, that's just one instance. But again, you know, that's just an incident where you can have one officer watching several cameras at once that is far more efficient than having each camera be a correctional officer.
Danny, I'd pose the same question to you.
Well, first of all, they're not prison guards. They're correctional officers. They're professionals. And a correctional officer can't see what's going on inside the cell by shooting a camera down the cell block. The interesting thing about what they call critical incident reports is that we ought to be talking to the employees to find out what's not getting reported, because I get more information from the employees about what's not happening in the institutions than I get from the department. 2005, that escape, that was planned when we had something like 600 cameras inside the institution. The problem is they cut the post inside the master control to where we didn't have adequate staff to watch those cameras. So you can have all the technology you want. If you don't have the staff members inside the building to tell you what you need, to watch what you're doing, you're going to have problems. And we're not. I'm not talking about Ask Me doing a study in 2006 through 2008. We did that study with the National Institute of Corrections. And they helped us determine we were 400 to 600 officers short. If we were 400 to 600 officers short then, we're 400 to 600 officers short now, if not more. And what's really happening inside our prisons is the type of inmates we're dealing with. The number of inmates that have mental illness, that have issues to deal with. So what was the Department of Corrections answer and this governor's answer? We shut down CCU. We're closing a building that's 20 years old that was designed to deal with mental issues with inmates, and we're shutting it down, and we're dispersing those inmates through the rest of the system where they don't have the facilities, they don't have the trained staff, they don't have the trained psychologists to deal with those inmates. And our incident reports have gone up since we moved them in there. We have had two major fights at the Iowa State Penitentiary in the last month. You know, they're not being reported. I talked to my staff and the members that work inside those prisons almost daily about what's going on inside. And I get critical incident reports about somebody feeling sick and going home, and I'll call the officers and ask them what's going on. I said, did you get the one about the fight? Nope, didn't get that one. And the ones that I get are watered down. The last suicide at the Iowa State Penitentiary, the department released that they cut that inmate down immediately. It took them over an hour and a half to cut that inmate down. I have the times from the officers that were there. They let the inmate hang for an hour and a half in his cell. And that ain't what the critical incident report said, and that is not what the press release said. So something's going on inside our prisons. We're trying to hide stuff.
So, Representative Baltimore, do you know what the priorities are for the Department of Corrections when it comes to mental health of inmates, kind of something that keeps kind of occurring here?
Well, I would defer to the Department of Corrections mm-hmm. to tell you what their approach is and all that. I mean, we've certainly been in contact with them. We've heard some reports from them about what they plan on doing with mental health. But I think for a specific statement, I would let them speak on that.
So what role do you see the legislature playing? Our producers here at Iowa Public Radio looked at FTE reports from the Legislative Services Agency. They looked at numbers reported by the Department of Corrections on their website, and those numbers seem to match up pretty well with what's budgeted. What kind of role does the subcommittee you sit on, and what role do you see the legislature playing in determining if there should be more staff?
Sure. Well, you know clearly we go off of the recommendations of the management, the team that's in charge of managing the prison. I think the last thing that you want is a legislature that sits there and tries to micromanage down to, you know, one or two FTEs or whatever level is appropriate. We've got a lot of things that we have to deal with, and our job is to take management's recommendations, figure out if on a global big picture scale that's something that's appropriate, and then make some appropriation decisions based on that. But, you know, we get into a lot of other areas too, such as, you know, sentencing and criminal laws that also impact, you know, inmate populations and things that are there as well. So, you know, there's a lot of different facets to the work that we do in the legislature.
We're going to go back to Patty Walkendorf of the Mitchellville's warden. Here she is talking about the challenges of limited staffing.
Our staffing is very short. We do the most we can with what we have, but it's tough and it's frustrating because we want to do more, because we want to see success. But we have realities that we have to deal with as far as the resources we do have available. We have a lot of limitations here, but we continue to do a lot because of staff enthusiasm. Staff wants to make it work. Staff has figured out a way to get 9.5 hours out of 8 hours of being here. So we couldn't do what we do here without the staff commitment to do it, and then volunteers. But most of our budget, probably 85% of our budget, is staff salary. So really I have very little discretionary funds that I can use.
So there's Patty Wackendorf from the warden from the Mitchellville prison. Danny, do you hear from your members about, you know, she talked about 9.5 hours squeezed into 8 hours. I mean, is that – what do you hear from some of your members and what they're doing on a day-to-day basis?
Well, they're not getting their contractual breaks or meal mm-hmm. periods like they're supposed to be getting. It's unfortunate that we're asking employees, and let me make this statement. The officers and the correctional staff that work inside our prisons are extremely dedicated, and they care about the job they do. They care about protecting the public, they care about protecting themselves, and they care about protecting the inmates. But they're not getting the support. They're not. They don't have the staff. And the diagnosis, since Mr. Baltimore didn't want to discuss it, since he doesn't have a prison in his district, let me give you some of the facts. 28% of the inmates at the Anamosa State Penitentiary have been diagnosed with a mental illness. Corinda, 32%. Fort Dodge, 23.8. Mitchellville, 57.8%. Iowa Medical Classification Center, 28.7. The Forensic Hospital, 94.1 at IMCC.
And these are all mental health?
These are all mental health institute, and I'm not I'm making it up. I'm taking it out what was presented to the Iowa legislature in the Senate Judiciary hearing. So they do know, but we're just refusing to recognize it. And so what did we do this year? We shut down an institution in this state that's designed to deal with these people, that was built to deal with these people and to address their needs. And we shut it down, and we're moving them amongst 3 or 4 other prisons. I said it when they were talking about doing it in the legislature. It doesn't make any sense. The building's 20 years old. There's nothing wrong with the building.
But we are building new prisons. Correct?
We're not putting them there. They're not going there. They're going to be shipped to the other prisons. Yep, ISP, Cell House 218, Cell House 318. You know, you ought to go down and see what the officers have to put up there. But I would venture to guess, if we put odds on it, that there's going to be a whole bunch of officers aren't going to move to that new prison because they don't believe it's safe. Heck, they stole the blueprints for it.
And so how do you know that this is that they'll be shipped to the others?
They've already done it. Okay. We have basically removed probably 80 to 85% of the inmates out of CCU at Iowa State Penitentiary, and they have been moved to other prisons, which has made those prisons even more overpopulated than what they currently are. It's a system that's waiting to break down because we haven't funded it properly.
Representative Baltimore, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Well, I think it's interesting that we're hearing from Mr. Holman of incidents that don't get reported, of employees that are supposedly skipping breaks or not being allowed breaks that they're contractually obligated and allowed to have. Now, Mr. Holman, I think, certainly knows the grievance process through our collective bargaining system, and I would imagine if this were a widespread problem, we'd see grievances filed left and right. I would agree with Mr. Holman on this point. The people that we have working in all of our institutions do a fantastic job, and they work very, very hard, and they do so, as the warden there of Mitchellville indicated, they do so because they have a passion for what they do. And I certainly appreciate the very hard work that they do on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, with some very, very difficult situations. But, you know, we can only deal with what's reported. And comes through. I deal off of the incident reports that are there. Those are the statistics that I have. If there are incidents that are not being reported, I think that's a problem. I would encourage Mr. Holman and his organization to make sure that they follow up to make sure that if there are incidents that they do get reported, they get reported accurately. I think that's the only way that anybody can make responsible decisions. But again, that's not a situation where I'm hearing a widespread problem on that particular matter.
And Martin, the conversation that you're hearing taking place here in Iowa, is this a common conversation that you're hearing in your study and research around the nation?
Very much so. This is a very common dialogue, difference of opinion. But I think that the best way to approach it is to come together to agree on a neutral party, perhaps the National Institute of Corrections, perhaps some other neutral party, to do a staffing analysis, as I described, and to reach agreement on what is needed. I think the fact that so many of the inmates are mentally ill, and that has definitely changed in the last 20 years throughout the United States in prisons, changes the nature of the work. It changes the staffing need. And you can't simply say, well, the number of inmates is higher or lower. You know, Mr. Homan is right. You know, you can have closed circuit TV, but someone has to watch it. So I think there is a way to answer the question. I think it's imperative for the welfare of the public, the safety of the public, the welfare of the inmates and the safety of the employees, and for the, you know, public purse, that we reach a common understanding on what appropriate staffing levels are. We don't want to burn out the staff.
Okay. Sorry to do it to you again, Martin. I appreciate for being on the show. Thanks for being on River to River. Also to Danny Homan and to Representative Chip Baltimore, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio.